مثلا عملت ايه؟
Unmute. There we go. Hi. Right. My audio on? Can the people hear me?
No, son, you're not really very
yes.
Loud. Right. Let's see what we can do. Can I be heard right now?
That's better.
Oh. All right. Hello, everyone. Hope everyone's doing well. Sort of in the last week before we come back. For sure next week, God willing. So I appreciate that this chabar is advertised as parasha chabara, and whilst I'm technically talking about the haftarah, it doesn't happen to be this week's haftarah, it's last week's haftarah. But the haftarah itself was related to the period between Shavuot Sabbat Tammuz and Tisha B'Av, and so at the very least it has relevance for us at the moment. So I'm going to share screen. I have a presentation. Very fancy. A minute. And yeah, there we go. So we're going to be discussing the first parak of Yirmiyahu. Now, a few preliminary points to emphasize before we get started. First of all, I'm going to be using some narrative theory in this, let me see if I can minimize it. I'm going to be using some narrative theory, within this to basically analyze the character of Yirmiyahu. But doing such does not suggest that the story isn't true or that Yirmiyahu is a fictionalized narrative in the sense that we're going to be looking at him almost as if he was a fictional character. But of course, these things are equally true, whether he's real or not. And he was real, most certainly. Second of all, I'm not a narrative theorist, and my knowledge is rudimentary at best, which is, I think, important to emphasize because I'm not particularly experienced in a lot of these things. And the third is that the analysis here will be through the eyes of the Abai Ranel, whose picture you can see looking rather epic on the side of the screen. And there are other ways to read this chapter. So what we're going to do, first of all, is we're going to go over what happens and outline the Abai Ranel's questions that he asked. The structure of the Abai Ranel throughout his commentaries is that he asks a series of questions and then provides answers, usually linking them together. And I'm going to try and sort of link together his answers sort of in a cogent sort of narrative throughout the chapter. So the first section of the chapter begins with an introduction to Yirmiyahu. So we find out a number of things about him. We find out his family, we find out where he lives. We also find out when he prophesies. Now, the first question the Abai Ranel asks is, this is a rather unusual thing. We don't get this a lot with the other prophets. Usually we just find out sort of when they were born or when they started prophesying. Here we get the entire sort of outline of when he was prophesying, the exact number of years and the kings that he was prophesying during. And so the Abai Ranel asks, why is this important? And further, if we're going to be mentioning all the kings, there are three kings mentioned here: Yeshayahu, Yoyakim, and Zidkiyahu. And that leaves two kings missing: Yehoahaz and Yehoyakim, who were both sort of brief kings for a couple of months during that time. So why are they missing? So those are the first questions. Next up, Hashem comes to Yirmiyahu. This is their first interaction, and he begins by telling him, "Before I created you in the stomach, I knew you. Before you exited the womb, I had sanctified you. I placed you as a prophet for the nations." And then Yirmiyahu sort of responds, "I'm a child. I'm not ready. I'm a nar." And God says, "Don't say that. Because do what I say. You're going to have to, you know, become this prophet." And then God reaches out his hand and touches Yirmiyahu's mouth. And God says to him, "Look, I've placed my word in your mouth." And so the Abai Ranel asks sort of three questions on this section. He says the first question, this is quite an unusual thing of him sort of saying to him, "Oh, you know, you're extra very special from the moment you were born. I created you and you were holy from the moment you exited the womb." Why do we specifically have this again with Yirmiyahu? Others, he suggests that others have said, well, it's because Yirmiyahu is sort of refusing. He says I'm a nar. He says that can't be it because you know, many prophets refuse. Moshe himself refused, and he never received the "you're extra, so special." The sort of second question on this passage, the third question overall, is just he asks sort of what do these things mean? What does it mean to sort of that Yirmiyahu was created holy from the womb? How could he have been placed as a prophet from before he was born? So what is this referring to? And the fourth question is, what specifically was Yirmiyahu upset about? What was his opposition towards the God's mission? Why does he say, "Oh, I'm a child"? Surely, you know, if God has chosen him, he must be ready for the job. The next thing that comes up is he receives two visions. The first vision is one where God says to him, "What do you see?" And he responds, "I see this almond branch." And God says that, using a bit of sort of wordplay in Hebrew, reading the translation, you won't really get this, which is the vision represents God is sort of very prepared to go do what his sort of mission is right now. And the second vision he then has is one of this boiling pot. This boiling pot represents the kingdoms of the north, which are going to wash over the Jewish nation and sort of bring the destruction. And the Abarbanel's question on this part of the section, his fifth question, is why does God say to Yirmiyahu, "What do you see?" This is also quite unusual for prophecies. Usually we expect when we conceptualize the prophets that they get this massive vision. Why does God need to ask Yirmiyahu, "What do you see?" Surely it's not really about him. And now we move on to sort of the next section, which basically he just reassures him. He's like, you know, go be strong. You need to go do this and you're going to be okay. And you're going to be an Iramiv Tsar, Amud Barazal, Chomis Nechoshes, kind of a fortified city, a pillar of iron, walls of bronze. You're going to be great. And then sort of the Haftarah ends. We go briefly into the second parak. The Abarbanel says the first prophecy sort of ends at this point. And we have kind of what is perhaps the most iconic pasuk in Yirmiyahu, the one I think a lot of people know, perhaps because of the popular song. Zocharti lo chesed nareich, remember the kindness of your youth. And the reference of the fact that the Bnei Yisrael, sort of ran straight after God into the Midbar, Eretz Lo Teruah, to sort of represent their kind of early commitments, towards them. So what I want to try and do is try and answer these questions, but represent it as a bit of a journey, which is Yirmiyahu sort of, how does he become ready to the point where he can deliver this prophecy? And so we're going to have a look at some rudimentary narrative theory. Now, I'm sure some of you have probably heard of a guy called Joseph Campbell, who sort of argued in his book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, that most stories were actually just one story. But his, looking at his kind of narrative circle, it is a bit specialized. It's more about like things that happen than why they happen. And this, in my view, is sort of a better way to conceptualize most narratives, which is this. This is the Dan Harmon story circle. Dan Harmon is a US television writer, but he uses these eight, sort of segments to judge how to write a story, which is a character starts in a zone of comfort. They have a need or a desire, which forces them to enter an unfamiliar situation, which they adapt to. They get what they want, but at a price, and then return to the zone of comfort, having changed. Now, for Yirmiyahu, he goes through this cycle in what becomes a very difficult life for him. But what we're looking at this chapter is specifically how we're moving from segment one, where he's in his comfort zone as a sort of man living in Anasos, to the unfamiliar situation of he has to go tell the entire Jewish nation that things are about to get real rubbish. And so we're going to look at how we get there. But I think first, just a bit of a deeper dive into segment two, which is this. Another film critic who I really like represents, at least for him, the way most good conflicts and stories work, based on seven dramatic questions. I'm going to be only really looking at the first three, which is this. Most conflicts and stories come between a conflict that a character has between what they want and what they need. Now, when I say need here, it doesn't necessarily reflect what they sort of in the same way you might need to go to shul in the morning or need to drink water to not get dehydrated. It's more need in the abstract, a thing that the character is required to go to get to based on the story itself. And the most fundamental drama comes between wants and needs conflicting with each other within the character. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at the chapter, try and split it up, and answer the Abravanel's questions and try and see what does Yirmiyahu want, what does Yirmiyahu need, and how do these things conflict, and how is he going to overcome this conflict. So let's go on to the first section again. So this is the first section again, and again, if we're using our sort of story circle, this is establishing segment one, the context for the conflict and the familiar situation, the zone of comfort. To answer the questions that we had about why these details are revealed, the Abravanel sort of goes into detail about which details the writer of Yirmiyahu decides to reveal to us. First, he is the son of Chilkiyahu, who is a Kohen, who he says first discovered himself a Sefer Torah, which began to prophesy himself towards the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. The Kohanim, which he lives with, who later in the book try and kill him, are mentioned, so as to foreshadow his eventual exit from this familiar zone. And third of all, he talks a bit about sort of, and for this we need sort of brief historical context as to who Yeshayahu was. Yeshayahu was was a king like roughly 40 years before the destruction. And he sort of led to a revitalization of religion and Jewish culture in the land of Israel. And the Abravanel says, well, it was in his merit that they merited to have as prolific a prophet as Yirmiyahu to try and protect them. And in that sense, his prophecy lasted only as long as that kingship lasted. And so the only king who we mention, the reason why the other kings aren't, is kings that sort of were essential to sort of the process of the decline. The other kings were not kings for very long, but these kings, they were sort of central to why he was allowed to be a prophet. But the most pivotal thing, and this kind of leads into what is going to establish the conflict this chapter has, is that he notes that Yirmiyahu prophecies in total, based on the time period outlined here, for 40 years. And this leads to his theory that when Yirmiyahu is saying, I'm a nar, it's not that he's saying I'm inexperienced, I'm not ready. He's literally saying I'm a child. He outlines that in his view, at the very least, based on his calculations, including other parts of the Sefer, he reckons that at this point, Yirmiyahu is 12 or 15 years old, which is, again, sort of reframes our understanding of who this man was. To sort of get handed such a miserable mission. It really is miserable. At such a young age is especially difficult. He sort of brings other proofs for this. He discusses the fact that much later in the Sefer, God tells him not to get married, which suggests that at the very least for the first part of the Sefer, this wasn't an issue. So at the very least, that sort of supports these ideas. So now we've answered the first question, we're going to go on to the second. We're going to stop talking about the wants and the needs that this character has, which is simple. The want for Yirmiyahu is essentially he wants to have the chance to grow up. This isn't a want of someone who wants to reject God's mission or not go prophecy, kind of in the vein of Yonah. It's more that he would really like to do what God tells him to do. He has that faith, but he also feels that he's incapable of it. He wants the chance to be able to do this properly, and he doesn't feel like he has the capacity to do it properly. And this is why the Abravanel explains he receives this "You are extra so special." It's because as a child prophet, he especially needs this kind of thing, because he talks a bit about how prophecy doesn't just come to sort of people who don't deserve it. Generally, you have to sort of be a person of good moral character, good Jewish knowledge, good relationship with God. And so, this is a perfectly legitimate concern. So when God says these things to him, and he goes into detail about the ways in which sort of the words demonstrate the specific kind of relationship that God has with him, he's basically telling him that you are ready, despite the fact that you don't feel you're ready. And this already we can see kind of the conflict. Yumiro wants to do this properly by getting to grow up, but he needs to do it now. And this is the way the Ravenel conceptualizes the entire chapter. It's about Yumiro's journey to accept that his prophesying needs to begin immediately, despite the fact that he isn't ready for it as far as he's concerned. And this is specifically what it says in Pasuk Zayin. God says to him, don't say you're a child. Now, the Ravenel explains this is, like, it's not that he's not a child. It's just, don't go around telling people you're a child. You can't act like a child. You have to grow up. You can't show the cowardliness that is often associated with young people. You need to kind of go out there and be strong. And so sort of now we have a bit of a sense of that conflict. And I think at the very least, the next passage outlines the need kind of slightly better, which is that the Abravanel explains what's going on here with the what do you see? And he explains, and this doesn't seem to be unique to Yirmiyahu. He describes it as like an Inyan Godol b'Nevuah. So sort of other prophets kind of saw this as well. And you know, I'm fairly sure like the Netziv discusses how Moshe may have been different from this, but pretty much everyone else has this experience, which is that God sort of presents the idea in prophecy, and then the prophet themselves has to kind of fill in the gaps to sort of visualize the idea that God has planted in their head. And in that sense, a prophecy becomes this kind of reconstructive creative process. And so God delivers this idea to Yirmiyahu, who has a sense of set of wants, and asks him, what do you see? And by asking him what he sees, Yirmiyahu sees a bunch of things which outline to him very clearly his needs. And he goes into sort of how Yirmiyahu can sort of begin to recognize these things. He talks about the fact that instead of saying like an eight shockade, like a almond tree, he specifically says makel, which is sort of associated with makel to be like a stick. He already recognizes the fact that sort of whatever is about to come if the Jews don't repent is itself a sort of difficult and violent response. He also talks about the image of the boiling pot. Why a boiling pot? Because pots boil very quickly, and when they spill over, they sort of be incredibly damaging sort of quite quickly. He looks at the Pasuk Yudalit, talks about Mitzofen Tiposach Hara, from the north, the evil shall open. And he explains this as referring to the fact that there will be another exile in a couple of centuries' time from the second Beis HaMikdash, and that would be sort of the bad thing there. And so sort of, you know, what Babylon would begin, Rome would conclude. And so through this process of prophecy and through his revelations with God, Yirmiyahu at the very least is beginning to understand the difficulties that he's going to have to face, and the fact that despite what he wants to do, there are sort of needs. There's a very violent thing that is coming very quickly, and if he is to achieve something, he needs to go do it now. And I think this leads into sort of the movement between segment 2 and 3 as he sort of moves into the unknown, into his unfamiliar situation. He talks about God basically tells him again, you're going to be this strong person, you have to go Tezor Masnechov, come to the Baal Talim, got to go talk to these people, and you have to sort of like, this is the time, you have to go do this now. And I think at the very least, this can kind of take us into the final thing, which is sort of what is Yirmiyahu specifically saying here? And I think at the very least, one could perhaps draw a parallel between the prophecy that he's told to deliver here and Yirmiyahu himself. What are the Jews being praised for here? They're being praised for the fact that they went out into a non-seeded land, sort of an open land where they were very unsure of themselves. If we want to conceptualize them in terms of the conflict between wants and needs, Jews wanted security. They wanted, and we see this a lot in the Midbar, they kind of, their conflict is between they believe in God, but also they want, you know, the comforts that they remember. And in this instance, they have a conflict between their wants and their needs, and the fact that they need to sort of go out in the Midbar, take that journey. And they do. And so, at the very least, this becomes a very resonant prophecy for Yirmiyahu to give, because this is very much what he's doing here. As we've seen, the difficulties and the power actually more come to reveal the specific struggle that Yirmiyahu has to go through to kind of realize his mission. And he has to go out into the Midbar of Eretz Lezeruah. And, you know, I think it's worth remembering that the sort of Yirmiyahu's life was not a happy one. He suffered tremendously and sort of, you know, and if his mission was to prevent the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, it's a story ultimately of failure, a noble failure, but failure nonetheless. But I think sort of, at least for us, what can we sort of take out from this? I think as we approach Tisha B'Av, and sort of in this difficult period, of kind of history right now, it's worth remembering that sort of these conflicts between wants and needs, by the things we want to do, things which are necessary for us to achieve sort of our missions and goals in the world, those conflicts, they're difficult. And the first page of Yirmiyahu doesn't shy away from the difficulties that one can face, especially, you know, the specific challenge here is that often things will arrive when we're not specifically ready for them. Something that we would have been perfectly happy to do in a couple of years' time is suddenly here now, and what do we do? But I think sort of at least this conclusion of the parak sort of gives us a message of hope and a sort of almost instruction as to what we do next, which is that in a case where we have a conflict between our desire, our want to stay in a zone of comfort and to feel ready, sometimes when it's what we need, we have to go out into the midbar. Thank you very much. Hope you enjoyed. If you have any questions, I can answer sort of at a different time. I don't want to keep people. Have a good Shabbos, everyone.
I love you.
All right, Gran.